Well, you've heard a fair amount, and we'll hear more about the benefits of visiting ADS space. Presumably, one is living on the boundary. But what I want to do, the theme of this talk, will be to explore a little bit to what extent the benefits of visiting ADS can be acquired without actually having to be in ADS itself. And so I will, in fact, in the process of doing that, discuss a certain amount of old results. As you see here, in addition to new horizons down here, I will first tell you a little bit about some old horizons and even non-horizons. But the new things that I will say are essentially taken from work in progress with Harmjan Boonstra and Kostas Skenderis on the main wall issue here, and with Jerome Gauntlet and Rob Myers on this topic here, which is, in fact, how I originally chose the title, The New Horizons. So, without further ado, let me just mention, go back a little bit to view brains as interpolating solitons. This will be kind of a theme that I'll take off from. There are certain standard cases. There are, in fact, many other cases, but let me just mention the few here. The simplest ones, in a sense, are those that come from M-theory, the M-theory brains and the D3 brain. And the idea is you have, if one just looks at the exterior spacetime, then the Penrose diagram looks like this. And the point about these solutions is that these, of course, have the property that I'm saying here, partly because the dilaton is constant, or in the case of M-theory, there is no dilaton. And they simply interpolate between two asymptotically regions at asymptotic infinity. If you go out one direction, you get to Minkowski space. And on the other hand, if you go in this region, you end up with some Klutz-Klein compactification of supergravity. And those Klutz-Klein compactifications are those that were studied in the days of Klutz-Klein theory, were known since then. And, of course, they were shown in those days to, in fact, be maximally supersymmetric solutions. So, therefore, one gets a maximally supersymmetric vacuum here, another maximally supersymmetric vacuum there, and an interpolation between the two. And, of course, down in this vacuum, you have, instead of the super Poincaré group, you get the Sitter supergroup, because that's the isometry supergroup of that background. Well, so that's the old horizons. But in fact, actually, in the paper I wrote with Gary Gibbons back in 93, we actually also discussed one other case, which is, in fact, perhaps an example of a non-horizon, because as shown by Horowitz and Strominger, the Nibber-Schwarzweil brain is, in fact, completely non-singular. Although, actually, there's a null singularity, but it's, in fact, at infinity on all geodesics. It's an infinite affine parameter. But the crucial thing is that in this exterior region, there are, again, two asymptotic regions. And so out here, again, you have 10-dimensional Minkowski space. But if you go down into this region here, you can ask, well, what is it? And you end up with some other solution of supergravity. The whole thing is a solution of the supergravity theory. So in particular, it's also a solution in this limit. And if you ask what that is, you discover, in fact, that's an S3 compactification that, in fact, wasn't discussed in the old Klutz-Klein days, because, in fact, it compactifies not to a Minkowski space, but, in fact, to a domain wall space-time in seven dimensions. And, of course, again, there's going to be some effective theory down in this region. Now it has to be a seven-dimensional supergravity theory. Well, you compactify it on S3. In fact, you're going to have an SU2 times SU2 isometry group. In fact, what happens here in this context of, if one views it in the context of N equals 1, as they say here, T equals 10 supergravity, then in fact the theory becomes, it reduces into a supergravity coupled to matter. So one SU2 factor is in the matter sector and the other SU2 factor is in the supergravity theory. And, one can conjecture that what happens for N equals 2 is that, again, it has to be some other gauge supergravity theory that actually has both SU2 factors. And there's only one candidate that's known to date, that was the SO14 GHD equals 7 supergravity constructed by Warner, Van Nieuwenhuizen, and somebody else. sorry to somebody else, but and the one feature about this case is that in fact there's no supersymmetry doubling. That is to say, the full solution breaks one half supersymmetry, but so does the asymptotic solution down at this end. Now, one feature that you can notice about that solution, if I, for example, just take the case, the n equals 2 case, which in either case, you can notice that if you look at the R symmetry group of the brain, and that can be done either in the higher dimension or or look at the domain wall down in the lower dimension, then that's some field theory on the brain, supersymmetric, and there's some R symmetry group associated with it, exactly as in the ADS case. And in all cases, the R symmetry group corresponds to the gauge symmetry group of the effective supergravity theory. So the correspondence between R symmetry on the brain and gauge symmetry in the bulk, extends beyond just the ADS-CFT correspondence, much more generally to these domain wall spacetimes. And in a certain sense, the ADS itself can be just viewed as a domain wall, a rather special case of one. Here's another example of that. So this is this work in progress with Boonstra and Skenderis. Another example of that comes from, if you take the 6 brain, for example, D6 brain, then the R symmetry group in that case is SU2, since it's Yang-Mill theory reduced from 10 dimensions. And on the other hand, if you just look in an appropriate frame, I haven't written down the metric here, in an appropriate frame, you see that this is just S2 times some 8-dimensional space-time. Well, after transforming variables appropriately, you can realize that, in fact, this is actually a one-half supersymmetric domain wall solution of an effective D equals 8 supergravity theory. And indeed, the 8-dimensional supergravity theory has to be some S2 compactification of the 2A theory, in which the two-form Kaluza-Klein field strength is proportional to the volume form. That can, in fact, be viewed as an S3 compactification from 11 dimensions. And indeed, such a theory actually was constructed a long time ago by Salam and Sezgin. It precisely has SU2 gauge group. You can look at its solutions, and you find, again, you find precisely the domain wall solution, which is the 6th brain. So Salam and Sezgin, in some sense, well, their theory, at any rate, if not they, knew about 6th brains. So that's another example of how this correspondence extends more beyond just ADS spacetimes, also to these domain wall spacetimes. And at the same time, that's nice because it gets into the picture many other gauge supergravity theories that haven't yet been discussed very much, but must somehow fit into the picture. Well, now I want to move on to horizons that come actually from intersecting brain solutions. And, well, this has been discussed, I think, this particular example I'm discussing by a number of people, but in the context of 11 dimensions in a nice paper by Boonstra, Peters, and Skenderis. So if one just takes the previous solution, for example, if I add a 2B string to the, add a string to the Neuer-Schwarz phi brain to cancel the dilaton dependence. So the point about that previous solution was that, in fact, as you went down into the asymptotic region, the dilaton was not going to a constant. But one can cancel that non-constant dependence by adding in some more brains. If you do that, dualize and lift to 11 dimensions, so there are various equivalent configurations one can consider. Let's consider this one. You have a 2-brain intersecting a 5-brain over a string. That's actually a solution with 1/4 supersymmetry, as is typical for 2 intersecting brains. And of course, it interpolates between a fully supersymmetric Minkowski spacetime at one end. And on the other hand, in the other asymptotic region, you get a doubling of supersymmetry. You had a 1/2 supersymmetric solution with ADS3 times S3. Well, if you add an M wave to that, then you, in fact, further break the supersymmetry here down to 1/8. But that actually has the same asymptotic limit to ADS3 cross S3, and the reason for that is because a wave can be removed by a diffeomorphism at ADS3. We learnt this fact from Horowitz and Marolf, but it may be more widely known. In any case, the consequence of that, well, this is... perhaps an amusing rather than important consequence, is simply that in this case you actually get a fourfold increase of supersymmetry as you go near the horizon. So it's not that you always get just a doubling, or even that you get a doubling at all, as I was saying previously. Sometimes you get a fourfold increase. And I'm not sure if that observation had been made before, but if not, it will be. well, now I want to come to a case which is the so-called Tangalini black hole in five dimensions. And this was discussed, the issues that I'm discussing here, the doubling of supersymmetry, was shown in a paper by Chamsuddin. Oh, you can't read the authors up here. I should move this down. Chamsuddin, Ferrara, Gibbons, and Kalosh. Still can't read them. And the point, so this is just essentially the generalization of the five-dimensional, the Rice and Nordstrom solution to five dimensions. And of course it took Gary Gibbons to dig up the original reference to Tangalini. I presume it was him. That solution, in fact, then has a near-horizon geometry, which is ADS2 cross S3. However, I think that one of the issues that hadn't previously been addressed was that one knew that there was a near doubling of supersymmetry near the horizon. It wasn't entirely clear, though, what the near-horizon supergroup was. And if you start thinking about it, you can get a little bit puzzled there. In fact, Jerome Gauntlet and Rob Myers and I decided to just answer that question directly. In fact, there's a simple way to do it, much simpler than some possible alternatives. All you have to know is the killing spinners. And essentially, you just multiply the killing spinners together. That gives you all of the killing vectors that appear in the QQ anticommutator. So you immediately see what the supergroup is. So I can tell you the answer is SU11/2, and then there's another SU2 which doesn't play any role in the supersymmetry group. That's a little bit surprising because, in fact, that's exactly the same group as for the Rice and Nordstrom black hole. So just being in five dimensions and now having a three-sphere doesn't, in fact, get you any further in terms of the supergroup. It's exactly the same one. That, of course, that's a case where you have ADS, and as I said, the theme of this talk, to some extent, is to see to what extent you can get away from ADS. And one way you can do that is essentially by these authors who introduced rotation. Now, of course, you can have rotating black holes already in four dimensions, for example. The rotation group is SO3, so you have one rotation parameter. And then if you go to five dimensions, then, well, the rotation group is SO4, so you have two rotation parameters. However, supersymmetry, well, actually, there's a little confusing point here because supersymmetry actually says nothing about rotation. It just says that the charge has to equal the mass. But, of course, if you combine supersymmetry and require that the solution have be non-singular, at least outside and on a horizon, then, in fact, that constraint actually, in the case of four dimensions, actually forces you to put the angular momentum to zero. But in the five-dimensional case, in fact, it just tells you, just essentially puts one constraint on two parameters. So you actually have a one-parameter class of a supersymmetric five-dimensional black holes where the parameter is a rotation parameter. Actually, that's a little bit puzzling because if you think about it from ordinary rotating black holes, you know that typically if you have a black hole that's rotating, you're going to have an ergosphere, and the time-like killing vector field will go space-like outside the horizon. And of course, that can't possibly happen in a solution that's supersymmetric. But on the other hand, it must happen if the horizon has a non-zero angular velocity, which is what you'd expect if you've added rotation. But it turns out that this is a case, in fact, where the horizon, although the solution is rotating, the horizon is not rotating, actually. Somehow the rotation is carried all by the fields living outside the horizon. In fact, what does happen to the horizon is that it gets squashed. Well, the solution itself, actually, I haven't written down the solution, but if you go near the horizon, this is the near-horizon solution, you see if J is equal to zero, this actually is ADS2 cross S3. But in fact, it's not a direct product, space-time, when the rotation is non-zero. However, if you look at fixed T, you see that in fact, fixed T, fixed rho, the horizon, I should have said fixed rho too, you intersect the horizon and look at fixed time. the horizon is in fact a squashed three sphere. So the rotation actually corresponds to a squashing of the horizon. And the space-time itself is not ADS anymore. It's not a product of ADS with anything else. Now, given that and looking at that solution, you would be surprised to read in a paper that, in fact, the supersymmetry is nevertheless still completely restored near the horizon. Nevertheless, that's what did appear in a paper by Kalosh, Rajaraman, and Wong, and I have to admit that I just didn't believe it. However, it's perfectly true, and in fact, you can deduce, you can essentially do the computation, you can repeat the computation they did, of course. However, which didn't produce the corresponding supergroup. However, if you just go through the calculation that I was indicating previously, you work out what the Killing spinners are, and then multiply them together to get the Killing vectors and work out what the supergroup is, you find indeed you confirm this result, that actually the supergroup actually is exactly the same as it was before. So although the space-time is no longer ADS times something, nevertheless you have the symmetries, the supersymmetries of ADS. The only effect that the rotation has is to break that SU2 that didn't have any role in the supersymmetry to U1. So now we know what the... So in this case, in other words, one still gets... Although you're not in ADS space, you can still have the notion that it's related to a conformal theory on the boundary, although quite what the boundary means when the space is not ADS isn't entirely clear. But so that's another case where one goes away from ADS, but nevertheless you still have the symmetries, the supersymmetries of ADS. Well, another thing you can do is not merely intersect brains, but intersect horizons in the following sense. If I go back to the case I was discussing earlier with the string and the 2B theory, say, with the string, these all have many dual versions, of course, but if I go back to the case, say, in 2B with the string and the five brain, Noah Schwartz five brain, then one can add another five brain. So the picture you have now in terms of intersecting brains is that two five brains are intersecting on a string, but they're not only intersecting over a string, but you put a string in the intersection in such a way as to have the dilaton go to a constant as you go near one of the five brains. What happens here is that, of course, now you can approach to one of the five brains or to both of them. And, you might think, there's a further horizon for the string, but in fact you've basically arranged, in order to get the dilaton to be constant, you had to fix that in terms of the other functions. So you can go near one five brain or the other one. Well, if you go near one five brain, you just get back to what was the previous results. But if you go near both five brains, then in fact you find now ADS3 cross S3 cross S3, two factors of S3. And an amusing point that was shown by Boonstra, Peters, and Skenderis is that they pointed out that in fact the supergroup that's associated with this space, it's clearly an ADS supergroup in three dimensions. And one of those, if you look in the list of ADS supergroups in three dimensions, you discover that one of them is this funny D1, as I used to call it, with a free parameter in it. And in fact, that's precisely the one that's relevant here. And the free parameter is in fact the ratio of the radii of these two three spheres, which is the same thing as the ratio of the five brain charges. I will come back to say a little bit more about this a few transparencies later. But in any case, these people have determined what the supersymmetry group is in this case. You get, of course, here you see you get back to the previous cases by simply taking the radius, by simply taking alpha goes to zero. You take the relative, essentially you're taking the radius of one of the three spheres to infinity. That corresponds to throwing away one of the five brains, or one set of five brains. So in a sense, this case is encompassing all the previous cases, well, except for the rotation, which I will come to in a moment. I should first say that in fact, of course, that by exactly the same logic that I was explaining at the beginning of this talk, that particular brain solution, if you go near the horizon, you deduce that there have to be some S3 cross S3 compactifications of these supergravity theories, which one can view either, in fact, as compactifications of the n equals 1 theory, or actually as compactifications of n equals 2. Let me discuss here the case of n equals 1, because that's better understood. In that case, actually, the solutions themselves were in fact, already known some time ago to Antoniadis, Backus, and Saniotti, who looked at this in the context of the heterotic string, and then more recently discovered again by Chamsuddin and Volkov. And basically, the connection, in fact, is a little bit surprising, because you see, again, this case is S3 cos S3 compactifications. Well, I should say the straightforward, there are various compactifications of S3 cos S3. In fact, the one I just realized, the one I was just discussing on the previous transparency was one in which the dilaton was constant. But in fact, in a sense, the simplest one is the case where you go to a domain wall vacuum. The dilaton is not constant. And in fact, that actually you can see more easily in that case that you're really discussing solutions of the so-called Friedman-Schwarz model of four dimensional. So there's a model in four dimensions constructed by Friedman and Schwarz. The gauge group is SO4, and had the funny feature that the potential, and this is rather typical of these cases with domain walls, that it has the potential depends exponentially on the dilaton, and there's clearly no stationary point of that potential. But nevertheless, there's still lots of solutions in which the dilaton is not constant, and one of them is a domain wall. And indeed, that domain wall is precisely the five brain you had up in. Well, actually, it's a combination of the string and the domain wall you had up in 10 dimensions. Now, one can ask what the effective supergravity is in the case of n equals 2, and there's some evidence there that in fact it's actually we know that in fact it's a sum theory now with SO4 cross SO4 gauge group. Truncates to the Friedman-Schwarz model, and essentially the only candidate is, in fact, Hull's SO44 gauged n equals 8 supergravity. So I think we're seeing some of these non-compact gaugings of n equals 8 supergravity enter into the game when one looks at these intersecting horizons. Fine. How many? Two or three? precision, then. Now. Oh, okay. Well, I'm getting to near the end. So now I want to come to the case where, in fact, I go to the kind of the case which covers all of the previous cases, because I want to go to the case where if we... So going back to this case where you have a two-brain intersecting two five-brains, this is the dual of the previous case I was discussing. So that goes to that takes you from Minkowski 11 to ADS3 cos S3 cos S3 times a two-dimensional Euclidean space in the context of M theory now, and you can add rotation to that. Now this time, in fact, you have two four-planes for each of the two five-brains. Each one is associated with one supersymmetry rotation parameter. So you end up therefore with two parameters consistent with supersymmetry. Well, I haven't written down the full solution here, although we know what it is. But if you go near the horizon, then you get something that's somewhat similar to the previous case I wrote down, although it's actually more similar to the six-dimensional rotating string, which I haven't discussed here. This is no longer a product of ADS3. Actually, in this case, you can make some, again, diffeomorphisms. You can change coordinates, in fact, to put it in a form where it still is a direct product. But what's more analogous, what's closely analogous to the five-dimensional black hole that I discussed earlier, is in fact if you add an M wave and you dimensionally reduce, you get an eight-dimensional generalization of the five-dimensional black hole, where now instead of ADS2 cross S3, you get ADS2 cross S3 cross S3, and that's in the non-rotating case. But and in that case, the supergroup is again this D21 alpha, as I was explaining before. It contains SL2R. But then SU2 times SU2. The SL2R is associated with the isometry group of ADS2. And again, the parameter is the ratio of the in the group theory aspect, this parameter simply tells you the relative weights of these two SU2 factors. And so now, however, we know the more general case where you have rotating here with two rotating parameters. And we're in the process. So that, in some sense, is the most general case, because you can get all the other cases either by putting the rotation to zero or by taking one of the radii to infinity. And our conjecture is that, in fact, with calculation in progress, that in that case you get a supergroup which is D21 alpha, the same supergroup, in other words, but with the SU2 factors removed to U1. And essentially that's related to the fact that the horizon in this case is essentially the product of two squashed three spheres, where the squashing parameters are the two rotations. So we will know whether that's true sometime in the near future. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you, and also thank you for finishing on time. Are there questions?
One in the back, I can't see who it is.
Yeah,
Miriam.
That's right, but ADS, well, you're discussing
So that's a, do I repeat comments or just questions? There's a relation between two sets of black holes that Miriam Svetich has pointed out.
Yeah, I think since you mentioned ADS3 cross S3, you're talking then about the six-dimensional rotating string, which, as you showed with Larson, one can make change of coordinates to remove the rotation parameter. However, the point is that one cannot do that after the reduction to five dimensions. So in the five-dimensional case, you cannot make a change of coordinates to remove the rotation.
Another question? Well, then let's thank Paul again.